Good morning. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Judiciary Committee. We're going to change the public hearing schedule since one of our staffers is taking care of some other business. So I'm going to start with a public hearing on 794. So I'll open up that public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 794 changes the way attorney fees are awarded in condemnation proceedings. It requires the government to pay attorney fees and costs if the judgment exceeds the highest offer instead of the initial offer. There is a dash 2 amendment, and that ensures the property owner will receive attorney fees and costs incurred on or before the offer of compromise if the owner accepts the offer of compromise or the owner rejects the offer and does not achieve a better result. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Martha, looks like Harry, and then Linda are the ones I have listed. So if y'all want to come on up, we'll just do this all together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino, representing the City of Portland. I've just submitted into the record a letter from City Commissioner Nick Fish in support of Senate Bill 794. Fortunately, he was unable to be here today, but with me today is Harry Auerbach, Chief Deputy City Attorney from the City of Portland, who will walk briefly through the bill and also address the Dash 2 amendments. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Harry Auerbach. I am one of the Chief Deputy City Attorneys for the City of Portland, and in that role, I manage the litigation practice group, which includes the folks who do our condemnation litigation. So we asked for this bill because a couple of legislative changes that have happened over the last few years, most notably one of the lesser publicized elements of Measure 39 changed the way that attorney's fees are awarded in condemnation cases and had what I think is the unintended consequence of making condemnation actions more difficult and expensive to settle. So let me just give a little bit of background and then run through what the bill is intended to do and then answer any questions that any of you all might have. And if I say stuff that you already know, just let me know and I'll move on to something else. But in the American system of litigation, for the most part, we require all parties to...
All right, everyone, I think we're getting into the CLE credit time.
Happy to sign whatever you need. We typically expect litigants to absorb their own attorney's fees. And but years ago, this legislature, previous legislatures, recognized that that's not entirely fair in condemnation actions because the property owner really is an innocent bystander whose property is needed for public purpose. And so, as long as I can remember, the statute has provided that property owners are entitled to recover their attorney's fees if they don't beat the offer that the government made them for the property. Now, up until 2 years ago, the law was that the government could make an offer up till 30 days before the trial of the case. And if the property owner didn't accept that offer and didn't achieve a better result, the government didn't have to pay any of the costs, expenses, or attorney's fees incurred by the property owner in the action. This led to a perception, and I want to underscore that, to my knowledge, my government body never did this, but some people felt that some government agencies were lowballing property owners up till just before the trial and then hitting them with an offer and require them to incur costs and fees that they couldn't recover, and that was unreasonable. So the law now is that prior to commencing the lawsuit, the government is required to make a written offer for the property. That's always been the case. And the property owner has 40 days to consider that before the government can file the lawsuit. If what the law now is that if the property owner gets a better result at trial than that initial offer that the government makes for the property owner recovers all costs and fees incurred. And there's no opportunity for the government to minimize that its exposure to those fees and costs along the way if they can't actually settle the case. And there's no incentive for the property owner to settle because if they do at all better than the opening offer, they're going to get all their fees and costs paid. So, and the practical, as I think Commissioner Fish's letter explains, there's a couple of practical reasons why it's very likely in any given case that a property owner is going to beat the first offer. One is the first offer is done based on what we know going in, and frequently we will learn something from the property owner in the course of our conversations or in the litigation that follows that we didn't know beforehand that affects our evaluation of the property, and that will result in a higher offer, but may still not be sufficient to settle the case. And if we had known about it at the beginning, we could have made a higher offer. The second thing is just sort of the nature of litigation. If I come in as a condemning authority and I say, well, the property is worth $10,000, and the property owner comes in and says, well, my property is worth $100,000, the natural tendency of juries is to try to find some place in between to set the value. And so while the property owner isn't going to recover necessarily everything that he or she is asking for, the odds are pretty good they're going to do somewhat better than what the government has offered, because the natural tendency of people is to view these things as floor and ceiling. So what we have come to you to ask you is to find a balance between what the law used to be, which I'll grant you was probably unfairly tipped in favor of the government, and what the law is today, which is out of balance in the other direction. And to do that, we've brought you Senate Bill 794, which has two components to it.
Why don't we focus on the Dash 2, since that's okay. What's going to be before us.
Thank you. The Dash 2 amendments are designed to allay a concern that was expressed by Oregonians in Action about the effect of the offer of compromise. They were concerned that the bill as drafted would have prevented the property owner from recovering costs and fees incurred up to the date of an offer of compromise. That wasn't our understanding of what the language of the bill as drafted did, and it was certainly not our intent. Our intent was exactly the opposite. So the Dash 2 amendments are designed to clarify that when the government makes an offer of compromise during the course of the litigation, the owner is entitled to recover costs, expenses, and attorney's fees incurred as of the date of the offer, whether the owner accepts the offer or whether the owner rejects the offer, unless at the end of the day the owner's result is lower than that initial offer, pre-suit offer, that means they don't get any costs or fees at all. So we want to make sure that, because the idea of the whole bill is that once you get into litigation, we know we're going to pay some of the owner's costs and fees, and we want to have an opportunity to minimize that through this offer of compromise mechanism that's available generally in civil actions, and pay only the fees up to the date of the offer if we make an offer that the owner doesn't beat. Does that help?
I hope so.
I'm ready to go, Mr. Chair.
All right.
See
it helps.
So we'd ask you to adopt the Dash 2 amendments. Mr. Honeycutt has advised us, and I think submitted a letter for you all, that Oregonians in Action doesn't oppose the bill with those attached to it. We think it's a good government bill and good for the people, and we'd ask you to adopt the Dash 2s and pass the bill with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Linda?
Thank you. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I had the enjoyable opportunity to bring Ms. Pellegrino from the City of Portland together with Mr. Honeycutt from Oregonians Action to discuss this compromise and this bill, having a longstanding relationship with Mr. Honeycutt. Actually, Dave and I talked about bringing some amendments into the 2007 session, and we didn't feel that the timing was appropriately ripe at that point in time. We do support the bill with the Dash 2 amendments. We do believe that it brings back a better balance to local government's interests as well as protecting the property owner in the same manner. So we would ask that you support the bill.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for getting them together. We had a couple meetings in my office, and they seemed like they could do kumbaya, and it looks like we have it with the Dash 2s. And so questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Fasansky. Isn't the government offer in a condemnation proceeding based on an independent third-party assessment?
Yes. Except in small cases, the statute provides that we're required to get an appraisal from an independent appraisal. The challenge is in knowing what exactly it is that you're appraising. And so...
Isn't that what appraisers do?
Well, yes. But they have to gather information, and sometimes our information is incomplete. In your run-of-the-mill case, not so much. I mean, if we're acquiring a whole property, for example, the facts about that property are usually pretty well known. You know the zoning, you know the current use of the property, you know, so you can establish what comparable sales are and so forth. But many of our condemnations don't involve whole parcels. They involve either a strip or just an easement underneath. And those are, in my experience, somewhat more challenging to evaluate. And so depending on factors that the property owner may know that we may not know about what they intend to do with their property, it can affect how the value goes. And, you know, appraisal, and I don't know if there's any appraisers in the room, they may disagree with me, but appraisal is, I think, as much an art as a science, and different appraisers are going to disagree about how they appraise property, and that's why we have trials.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 794? Not seeing anyone coming forward. I'll close the public hearing on 794. I'm going to open up a work session and for the purpose of adopting the amendment at this point. So we're going to go ahead and open the work session on 794.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 into the main bill.
Senate Bill Quest moves the Dash 2 into Senate Bill 794. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And where are we at on being able to move the bill?
We do not have the fiscal revenue back yet. We just got the amendment yesterday, so will take a few days.
All right, so we've got the bill amended. We'll go ahead and close the work session on 794. That would conclude. Do you have anything else that you need to do?
I don't.
All right, so with that, we're going to change counsel. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 245. We'll let Shannon get up here, and Doug, Dave, and Casey, why don't y'all go ahead and come on up.
Good morning. Senate Bill 245, the initial bill has been deleted by the Dash 1 amendment to this front in front of the committee members. The Dash 1 amendment provides that it is a Class B felony if a person commits the crime of fleeing or attempting to elude a police officer under circumstances that manifest an extreme indifference to the value of human life. It provides that eluding or attempting to elude under such circumstances would be a level 7 on the sentencing guidelines. We do, in fact, have both fiscal and revenues issued on the Dash 1. There is no revenue impact. The fiscal is indeterminate.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you're going to give us a little intro, and then we get a DVD. Do we have popcorn today? Or
no popcorn.
Okay.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, my name's Doug Harkleroad. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. I'm retired Lane County District Attorney. What we're going to do today, you've already heard the summary of the bill. It's pretty simple. Casey Cotting on my far right and David Ville, Assistant District Attorney from Lane County, are going to do the bulk of this presentation. We're going to go first with Casey, then David, and then if there's anything left to do, I'll do something.
All right. Thank you.
Chair Pernansky, members of the committee, my name is Casey Cotting. It's C-O-D-D-I-N-G. I'm a senior trooper with the Oregon State Police. Started in 2000. And I'd like to show a brief video of an allude that happened in 2005. It occurred in Lane County. And it's approximately 4 to 5 minutes long. And I can answer any questions.
Oh, that'd be great.
Joe Brzezinski, he may need to narrate from over there if that's okay, because there's no sound on
this. Fine. Casey, there's a microphone right behind you. We just need to have it pointed in your direction so we can get it recorded. Standing room only, ladies. You can come around here if you want to.
So this begins as a routine traffic stop for a violation. The lights are activated on my patrol vehicle. It's a marked patrol vehicle. The suspect, this is 30th Avenue going into Eugene, takes off at a high speed, and this begins the pursuit. And his actions, as we get into this, start to create a dangerous situation and an allude that was outside of the normal alludes that I've seen. So cuts across. This is now going to Lane Community College in Eugene. And right here you see a head pop up. That's a passenger in this vehicle. It was a female that was in the back seat that we were never able to identify, but we were able to confirm that she is in this vehicle. Where this starts getting, making this a extremely dangerous situation is we're heading back towards Interstate 5. Okay. This section is between Highway 58 and Eugene. It's heavily traveled. A lot of vehicles on this roadway.
What are you guesstimating the speed to be?
Speeds are up to 90 at this. And you'll see as I parallel him on the freeway, 80 to 90 miles per hour. What he does here is he'll go through this light. This would be the correct on-ramp to Interstate 5 traveling south. He goes through this, and he turns on the off-ramp. So he's now going against traffic on Interstate 5. I have to turn around because I cannot safely follow him. I take the correct ramp, and I'm now essentially trying to catch up to him and parallel him on Interstate 5.
He's going the wrong way.
He's on the wrong way. He's going southbound in the northbound shoulder. And it's going to be hard to see, but eventually we will be able to see him traveling on the shoulder at a high speed, see the dust that he's creating, and the vehicles that he's passing in a morning commute time. So there's a lot of vehicles traveling northbound, as you can see. He's up ahead on the shoulder, and you can start to see dust from his vehicle. We're coming up to Highway 58 intersection, and it's a real narrow shoulder here, and you can start seeing it, the dust from him.
There you go.
There you go. And that's an extremely narrow shoulder, and then you'll be able to see his vehicle. It's kind of hard from where I'm sitting, but he's still right here on the shoulder. See him traveling south there? And he's passing all those vehicles. That vehicle's coming on ramp, and now they have a vehicle at 70 going right past him. That stretch, that allude, was extremely dangerous, and the fact that we made it out of there with nobody getting hurt was amazing. But essentially, that is the end of the tape. At that point, we lose the suspect vehicle.
So did he head up 58 at that point, or was he still going?
Sir, he dropped off, and we believe he went down on Highway 99.
Okay, on Goshen.
And the interesting facts of this were that we were able to determine who that was through other officers having experience with a suspect in Douglas County that had committed several alludes in the same fashion. So through some tips from Douglas County and some information on the car, we were able to come up with a suspect, and it turns out he had done this before.
All right. Let's move to David.
Okay, let's can you hold?
Oh, I'm good.
Okay, let's go ahead and get the testimony in, unless it's to the video, if you want to.
It's to the video, but I can wait.
Okay, David.
Chair Prasanti, members of the committee. My name is David Bill, and I've been an assistant district attorney with Lane County since 1990. I helped prosecute this case. I was the prosecutor. And what was interesting about this case is what's interesting every time we get a case like this. And these cases are rare. We don't see too many of them where someone goes the wrong way on the freeway. We see a few more where people blow red lights at high speeds. I even had a case one time where someone eluded on the bike path along the river at Lane County. So once in a while, in rare situations, we get these very, very dangerous cases. And what's shocking to the judges, to the lawyers, to everyone involved, sometimes even the defendant, that the maximum sentence under the guidelines, because it's a level 2, is 30 days in jail. You get probation, and there's no way, even if they have a bunch of murders, huge criminal history, if they're a 2A on the box, they get 30 days. Under the one-third rule, some judges only want to give 10 days. I mean, everyone sees it's serious. I think everyone agrees, judges, defense lawyers, prosecutors, police officers, that this is the one box that's misplaced on the guidelines grid. We're submitting that we think a 7 would be a more appropriate box. We think that would be a more fair box. That would still give the opportunity with someone with not that much criminal history, they'd only be looking at a 90-day max. If someone had a lot of criminal history, they could go to prison, and they probably should go to prison for something that's dangerous. Again, our position is that these are rare, that there's not that many. But when these ones happen where people are put at risk of getting killed, in this case we counted, I believe, 65 or 66 vehicles that were passed on the freeway going the wrong way. We think that the sentence should be higher. I would also like to let you know that the Oregon District Attorney's Association, they support this bill also. That's all I have.
All right, thank you. Doug, do you have any other comments?
Just to say that Crime Victims United and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police also support this bill.
Okay, Shannon, and then we'll go to Senator Boquist.
And I just want to quickly apologize to members of the committee. Interesting illustration of the point. I did not have my guidelines in front of me yesterday, and I thought from my just memory, I thought it was a level 6. So your measure summaries have the wrong guideline level. I put that it was a 6 moving to a 7. So I just want to note that for everybody. It is my mistake.
First comment for the record and then a question. And I did notice on it says deletes the original bill, but it's not a traditional gut and stuff. It's really a rewrite of the same thing we already had some previous discussions. My question is because I'm not familiar with the matrix and all of that sort of stuff like that, is in this example that's here, is this someone who had a warrant out for them already? Was this someone involved in drugs? A little bit of circumstance behind it, so I at least get some common lay experience of how do we get to this box numbers we're all talking about now.
So my recollection is this suspect, we were never able to locate the vehicle. We were never able to substantiate, but it was believed that he did have a large amount of drugs in the vehicle, and that's what led to the elude. But due to the circumstances, we were never able to safely apprehend the suspect that day.
Thank you, sure.
And the individual that was as passenger never was identified?
Never able to identify her, and nobody would talk about it. So other than the video, that's the only way we knew she was in the vehicle.
And it's also common that a lot of individuals may actually have warrants out for their arrest, and for whatever reason, they'll elude, and it sounds like this could have been compounded with new offenses that were occurring at the time.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah, Chair Prasanti, David should tell you the rest of the story.
Okay.
Well, we don't really know why he eluded. He never admitted that he did this. He denied it. We went to trial. We went to a jury trial on this case. The identification was made by a photo, and the trooper that could match the photo to his face. We also had another witness that was saying it was him, but that witness was afraid to testify. We couldn't bring that witness to trial. He thought the defendant was going to kill him, and so we couldn't get that guy to testify. So we had a witness with him admitting that he was the driver, but he never told the police. We could never get that admitted into a court of law. So we made the case based on the identification of the trooper, and that was the evidence. But we don't know why he did it, for sure.
Can I follow up? It was drug-related.
We don't know.
The insinuation is that it was drug-related. Okay, that's good enough.
Yes.
We're shaking your hands. Okay.
Thank you. I'm interested in whether you always videotape like that. It seems like it's a pretty good record of what happened. Is it typical to have a camera in the car and to?
It is getting, yes, now it is. Most of our cars are slowly getting outfitted with even better technology than that. It's much clearer now, and you're right. It's an excellent way to depict what happened, and hopefully eventually all our cars are equipped with that.
And is it fixed to the car, or did you have like a videographer?
No, it's fixed on the ceiling of the car, they go directly to a hard drive, and then we are able to burn that and put it right on a CD. And
yeah, it's pretty interesting. Eugene has pretty well outfitted, I think, all of their vehicles now. And so in my practice, you get to see some pretty interesting stuff. And Dave and I always cringed in the old days because a lot of the lenses, you don't get the focus and the perspective, especially in DUIs. And you have an officer that's testifying as to what you're seeing, but the camera doesn't really pick up those movements that are so subtle. But today's stuff is pretty good. I mean, it's
getting a lot better.
Yeah.
I have another follow-up.
So apparently you were able to identify this person and charged him with eluding, but was he charged with anything else, like speeding, for example? Or?
He was. He was charged with recklessly endangering. Initially what we did is we charged him with, and it was either 65 or 66 counts of recklessly endangering. We counted the number of cars we could find. Before we went to trial, we decided that was going to take up too much time in the courtroom to go over 65 or 66 counts of recklessly endangering. And we knew we'd be shooting for the sky, you know, to even get him a lengthy jail sentence. Because what we do in these cases is we have to start going for the sentence on the misdemeanor. The felony almost becomes irrelevant. It's kind of crazy that you can get more for eluding on foot than you can for doing extreme indifference elude right now. Because the misdemeanor, you can get a year in jail for eluding on foot. But if you do it in a car like this, it's a 30-day max, and that's why the box is this place. So what we did is we went down to, we picked our best six cars for the trial. And I don't remember which ones they were, but we identified six cars. And so we went with six recklessly endangerings plus the felony elude. We went to trial, we prevailed on all the counts, and we actually got the longest sentence in Lane County. The guy's still doing jail time. He got a 73-month local jail sentence, but he couldn't go to prison because it was in the two box. But we had Judge Morrison, and he thought it was serious enough to give him the lengthy sentence.
Can I have one more question?
So this is just, I'm curious about, I understand that you said you couldn't follow him down he was going down the off-ramp.
Correct.
And I went to Lane Community College, so I know that that intersection very well. So he was going down the off-ramp, and you had to go back around and go down. I don't want to even try to speculate about why he didn't turn north and go with the traffic. Is this his
mode of
escape?
Intentionally.
Yeah, I mean, right, I believe he knew that I could not follow him. For safety reasons, policy reasons, there's no way I'm going to go the wrong way on the freeway. So he knew that. So his best bet is to continue south, and knowing that I would have to go all the way around to even get visual of him.
That's the thing that's amazing is because you do have to reposition yourself for the visual, and he could have potentially made that other turn, which would hedge on the other side and then get you back the other way. But it sounds like he went even past. If you remember, there is a Goshen exit going northbound. And it sounds like he may have gone beyond that and then made another turn back on to 99.
It's hard to say. I think he passed that exit, turned around, and eventually went the wrong way on that exit to get down to 99. Because had he continued south, I would have been right there with him.
Right.
I had to turn around the median. So
right.
He turned around at some point on the freeway.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. Is there anyone else who want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 245? Not seeing anyone, will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 245. And
do we have paperwork and everything?
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and open it up for the work session, and then we're going to have a discussion. So work session is open on Senate Bill 245. And I guess what we need to figure is this. Number one, I would like to have a recommendation on the adoption of the Dash 1s. And so if we can get that.
I'll move, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist moves the Dash 1s in Senate Bill 245. Is there any discussion?
Just for clarification, because this is all new to me, Category 7 versus Category 6, maybe Council could just give me a short lesson here.
Dave, do you have a Simpson guideline with you?
I brought some
copies. Could you? Yeah. I forgot. I would have brought mine down so we could have done. This is not as nice as when you get them in color, but this will actually show you. Oh, that, excellent. Doug, can we just borrow that for a moment?
So what was the...
I know, that's why we're only borrowing it. We're on the record, we're just borrowing it.
So to clarify, I had mislabeled it, so it's a level 2 on the grid, which means...
You can do it in color, because
okay.
I can't see in black and white.
Okay. Level 2 on the grid, which means that at its maximum, at the day of sentencing, you could get basically 30 days if you're looking at... Or they apparently went local time, so you can get up to a year in jail local time. on misdemeanors. But this is a felony, so we're looking at 30 days, sure. 18 months probation. What you're talking about now with the increase is that it would be a level 7. And what I wrote on the measure summary is correct. You have a presumptive probation sentence for someone who has less than 4 non-person felony convictions. Oh, I'm sorry, less than 4, sorry. So you're still looking at probation for anybody who has no priors or has up to 3 felony property offenses. Yes. But you're looking at 3 years of formal probation, and you're looking then at having up to 90 days, but typically that would be about 30 days jail. They do a 1/3 rule. So about 30 days jail on any of this presumptive probation plan.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
And so then this is the guidelines the judge uses, and it's guidelines. The judge can kind of go up or down within the parameters.
There's criteria that has to be met for going up or down for departures. But if you look at this again, there's that kind of a dark line that's if you go up 3 categories, and then you see how that stair steps up.
Check.
That there, it tells you what's going to be probation. And I think the point that needs to be made, when you go back down to the line that says 2, mm-hmm. you can see all the way across it's the same.
Yeah.
90 days on the top max and 30 days. And so when you read this, A through I across the top grid tells you the most serious. A is the most serious, I is the least serious.
Okay.
And then when you move this up into the line 7, you can see how that dark line is. You have those first 4 boxes, and so out to the side on the right-hand side, it says 7, and then it has F-I.
Okay.
Where
are you looking?
Right here.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so when you look on the side, it's dispositional, departure, maximum sentence, so it tells you exactly what your potentials are. And we don't have it on the back, but on the back side of the guidelines has the criteria for aggravated or mitigating circumstances. And that is what the district attorney or the public defender or defense attorney will be relying on to try to get the judge to go either up or down based on that criteria.
Okay.
All right.
I'm educated.
This would move it from where to where on here?
It will move it from a line 2 and move it up to a 7. Mm-hmm. And then what you do to determine where you're at on the 7, it depends on the defendant's criminal history. So I being the least, going back to the left to the A, and that's how you could have either probation or you could have prison time.
I'm pretty sure we have one in our office already. I've
never seen so much information on one piece of paper.
Mr. Chair, we can actually get
to these. Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds to me, one of the things that I'm going to ask, Shannon's already volunteered, but we'll get these because a lot of the stuff that's going to be coming over from the House will be more on the criminal side, and I think it's important for you all to kind of understand how this works as we get into that. So, Doug, thank you for letting us borrow your copy. Again, we're on the record, and we're giving it back. You know, ethics. Oh, we do pass that ethics
law.
There's
no fiscal at our level for this now.
All right. So at this point, I'm willing to, let's say, go ahead and pass this out and send it. Let's see, what's the fiscal on this?
It's indeterminate, and there's not a subsequent referral.
Okay. So what's going to happen is we'll pass it with the due pass recommendation, I would assume. And then the president's office will look at it and decide whether or not it needs to go to Ways and Means as to whether or not it needs to be put into the factor of what's going to move forward. And this is just to put on the record. The scenario that we have with the tightness of the budget is that there will need to be some priorities through the Ways and Means process for such as this having this. It's not a new charge, but the potential sentences could have an impact on the budgets. As we've had the testimony, Dave Ville has stated that we don't expect this to happen too frequently, that you'll see this being charged, so it should be de minimis from my perspective, but we just need to put all that stuff on the record. So with that, we got the amendment before us. Is there any objection to adopting the -1 amendments? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the SB 245 with the -1 to 4 with a due pass. With the due pass recommendation anticipating there might be a review by the President's office.
All right.
For redirection.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 245 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation, with the understanding that the President's office may determine that this needs to go to Ways and Means, and if so, that's their prerogative. So is any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. The chair will carry this one to the floor if it goes to the floor. All right, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 245. Thank you all for coming up and giving us the presentation. All right, with that, that takes care, I believe, of our public hearings. And so that moves us into our possible work sessions. And I'm looking at council to see whether or not we have the paperwork that we need for either of these two work session bills.
With respect to 570-4, we do indeed have the paperwork.
Whoopee! All right, so we're going to go ahead and open up the work session on Senate Bill 570. And gentlemen, this is the metal thefts. For anyone that wants to know that it's finally moving out, or at least we think it's going to move out. So why don't you bring us up as to speed where we're at on the 570s and what we need to be doing.
We have the 570s, the dash 4 amendments, my understanding is, were adopted when Ms. Braun was here earlier in the week.
Correct.
The dash 4 amendments have been reviewed. A minimal expenditure impact statement was issued. Essentially, there is no, that they are not issuing a further statement on that, and we do not have any revenue impact.
All right.
So it's ready to be worked.
So at this point, the chair would take a motion to move the bill as amended with the dash fours to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I move
570.
Senate bill, not House bill. It says House bill on here.
Oh, yeah.
Senate bill. I move Senate bill 570 with the dash fours to the floor with a due pass and the understanding there's a minimal fiscal and no revenue, and we need to correct the measure summary because this is a Senate bill, not a House bill.
Well, apparently our staffer has been spending way too much time on the House side. We'll have to make an adjustment on that. All right, so we have a motion to move Senate bill 570 as amended by the dash fours to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I just have a clarification question. We also adopted the dash threes. We didn't?
I don't think so.
I don't think we did.
Oh, I don't have any record of it.
No, I think the dash threes came in, meaning to our possession. And my understanding is we had the dash fours drafted because of an issue that was on the dash threes, and the dash fours provided for the closing of the gap on the catalytic converters,
right,
if I remember correctly.
And the dash four also changed some language.
Scribner,
yeah. And so my understanding,
I wrote that we adopted it, but that's maybe I got ahead of myself. So. All right. There's some clarification.
Dash threes were adopted on 4-8.
Were adopted on 4-8.
And the 8th of April. So maybe it was
Do the dash fours replace
the dash fours
would supersede, yes.
Okay. So I only have down the dash fours.
Yeah, I thought we went through
on
the dash 4-9.
But on the 8th, we adopted the dash three. Mm-hmm. I didn't have that.
Well, what I'm assuming happened is on the dash threes, we wanted to get the fiscal done,
mm-hmm,
and so we adopted the dash threes to move it to that point. And I don't have my summary in front of me that has that.
As long as it's clear if the dash fours replace the dash threes.
I definitely do as far as the writing. If we need to clarify perhaps on the record, but the dash fours are the dash threes with one change to the language.
That's
I thought we
so
did that.
If you adopt both, because since I have about a half a dozen measure summaries in my file for this, and if you adopt both amendments, then the last one sort of supplants an earlier one if it's the same language.
Well, the suggestion, Mr. Chair, why don't we just adopt the dash four?
Well, we did
adopt the dash four.
Yeah.
We just did.
We did.
Should we unadopt the dash?
No, I believe I made the motion, but I think in the motion that's on the record, the dash four was replacing the dash three on the record.
Yeah.
Right. We did that with Anna Braun was here
and 4-9
brought in, and we went ahead and moved that so we could have it in place. So the dash fours were, in fact, adopted. I do remember that.
Right.
And when you look at the dash threes and the dash fours next to each other, the dash fours are basically a repeat or reprint of the dash threes with the additional
scribblers.
And I just want to make sure it's clear for when they're...
And so this is what we're going
to do. Engrossing them.
So we're going to put on the record that it's the intent of the committee to move the dash fours. We understand that the dash fours do in fact replace the dash threes, and that the bill, when it comes to the floor, will reflect the amendments that are within the dash fours. All right.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, also we have a request that when staff writes in the part effective committee amendment, can they please identify which amendment it is? Because when we have multiple amendments, it's confusing.
Okay.
I can do that from now on. I typically on the, we just do it differently on the House, so I apologize. We don't usually put the effective amendment until after it's been finalized.
Right. I agree.
We get it adopted already, though. So it should reflect
that. That's fine. Okay. Is there anything else?
Senator Wissett? Yes, Chair Pruszynski, I'll be supporting this bill today. I do have some reservations about it. It seems to be focusing more on legitimate businessmen and not enough on middle thieves, from my standpoint. And it... I'm really concerned that it just creates a blueprint for the enlargement of the black market in the merchandising of stolen metal products. But I think it's a step in the right direction. I hope that some of those things can be addressed on the House side.
Well, I would tell you that on the record, we had a group of four individuals, including myself and Senator Boquist, and Representative Olson and Representative Barton, who worked on this. I would take the position that the original bill could be interpreted to be more, let's say, focused on the businesses and had criminal charges that were provided for businesses, the dash fours, even though they do have two areas of where criminal activity could be charged against a employee. It's based on, one, that the individual knowingly takes in stolen material and fails to report that the material has, in fact, been purchased from a suspected thief. And I believe the other one was dealing where the individual that is providing, or to say the employee or business, fails to complete the paperwork that is required in these type of transactions. Everything else that was previously provided for in the original draft of 570 has, if I remember correctly, has been pretty well taken off. The issues regarding criminal liability, it's still my opinion there are a number of existing statutes and laws to hold them accountable. Whether or not we should be looking at increasing penalties, the reality is, and what Representative Olson determined was there was a $10 million hit under the proposal that was being brought by one of the work groups. And under this day and time, there's no way that we were able to absorb a $10 million hit in increasing sanctions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Comment for the record. I participated in the work group at the request of the various business communities, and I don't remember how many times we met. It was a lot of times we met, and we took back each time until the representatives of the business community, you know, had brought me everything that they had, and I had brought to our work group, and we took back each of our products back to the various individuals. And I would echo what the chair said. There was discussion on, you know, places where we could have higher criminal penalties, but the bottom line is the fiscal impact would have been too great. And to my knowledge, I haven't been contacted since we've gotten to the dash fours by any of the community members that we've been in direct communications with back and forth. And I think, to my knowledge, this is the compromise everybody has agreed to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank you and Senator Boquist and the team for all your work on this bill, which I will be supporting, but I wanted to make just a brief comment from perhaps a different perspective, is that I understand that there is some concern based on organizations that tend to help, for example, homeless people and very low income, maybe people living on the street who previously had the opportunity to make a few bucks for life support, not necessarily for criminal reasons, and this will close that door to them because they won't have a home address to which a check can be sent. So that's just a concern that I had. I think overall the problems that were brought to our attention in the committee and the testimony, in the balance, I would support the bill, but if we're really cutting off a way for homeless people to make a few dollars, that's a concern that perhaps we can address through other ways of getting to the root problems. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mitch, I want to respond. I don't agree with the philosophy of those who said that this is going to close the door from someone that may be homeless. My understanding is that they would, in fact, still be able. What I'd heard is that they want to cash sales so they could have the money dispersed to them immediately. There's nothing in the bill that would require them to not be able to go through the transaction as anyone else. And my understanding, homeless individuals can, in fact, use alternative addresses for mailing purposes, such as shelters and other nonprofit organizations. At least that's my understanding. And if that's not the case, then we will, in fact, look at making sure that changes.
And for the record, that topic did come up, and it was the issue of, that homeless individuals could register at shelters, so on and so forth like that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that I do appreciate the hard work of the members who spent a lot of time and effort crafting this bill. It is a high priority for the businesses in my district, my district has been subject to a lot of metal theft in many different fronts, catalytic converters stolen from cars from different businesses. I had an instance where one business in my neighborhood in building a store was stripped of all the wiring twice during construction, not once but twice. After they replaced it, then it was stripped again. So it's definitely a big problem for the businesses in my district, and I appreciate all the effort that went into crafting, which I think is a very reasonable compromise bill. So I'll be supporting this bill.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? All right. With that, any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it will be so ordered. And Senator Boquist and I will co-carry 570 to the floor. Any other? So I'll go ahead and close the work session with Senate Bill 570. And regarding Senate Bill 265.
Mr. Taylor.
Okay. And so hopefully Mr. Taylor is coming. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 265. And we'll wait for Mr. Taylor to get here.
This says a referral to Ways and Means, doesn't it?
Well, it does note that, and I assume it does, and what we need to see if we got the paperwork. We are working on trying to expedite some of the that we know, such as the this bill that is destined to go to Ways and Means, so we can move it forward without waiting for all the paperwork. And I think the caucuses are discussing a procedure to help expedite that process. We're going to go in recess at this moment and wait until Mr. Taylor is able to get here, so we'll take a short recess.
We don't have the fiscal.
All right. We're back on the record on Senate Bill 265, and Mr. Taylor just told me that we don't have the fiscal back, so we're going to carry over 265 until tomorrow, which will be Friday, April 17th. I'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 265. And as I said, I believe that there are some ongoing discussions between the caucuses to try to help us expedite some of this stuff through, specifically the ones that we know that are going through Ways and Means, or two Ways and Means, and then also ones that we've had amendments that are just technical, that do not have any impact on a pre-existing fiscal statement. So stay tuned. Hopefully our caucuses will be able to work through this, and then we'll be able to expedite some of these matters that have been carried over more than once. With that, we're going to adjourn until tomorrow, Friday the 17th, and we're set for 8 a.m. start, and thank you very much. Yeah.